Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jim Flink. For more than a month, Venezuela has seen violent clashes between opposition demonstrators and government forces. Three people were killed in clashes on Wednesday, including a student and a National Guard member, bringing the death toll now to 26, with hundreds more people injured as well. For journalists, it is far from easy covering these protests. The country's television stations are mostly a propaganda outlet for the socialist president, Nicolas Maduro. The opposition newspapers are dependent upon newsprint quota, and that means that the government can deny them at almost any time. We have three guests joining us today. Francisco Toro is a Venezuelan blogger and an analyst living in Montreal. Laura Weffer is an investigative journalist living in Venezuela. And Freddie Gomez is a medical student who lives in San Cristobal, where the protest started, and he's been active in helping to treat some of the injured in those protests. And Freddie Gomez, let's go ahead and let's start with you and give us a sense of what it is like on the streets in these protests. Give us an atmospheric kind of look.
Sure. Well, San Cristobal right now, it's a big center of what it's called Guarimba, or which is barricades along the streets, main streets, small streets, which they stop all entrance to the streets and make the local to stop working and try to be safe from the colectivos or paramilitary armed people who shot and goes against these demonstrators.
Let's talk a little bit more about some of the causes here. We have a long history, recent history of violence, and Caracas, for instance, one of the most violent cities on the planet. There's rampant inflation, difficulty in getting very basic sorts of goods and services, things like toilet paper or milk, and that when you go to the grocery store, you sort of get a potpourri of whatever is there on the shelves. That's part of the frustration. What else is there, Freddie?
Well, it's especially harder here in San Cristobal, which is a border or near border city, and it's a hard state which has been really bad taken by the government, and we have been out of goods for several years. It's not now for us, but it's getting worse around the country. So if you look from another perspective, San Cristobal, it's tired of this. It's not only for goods, but gas, like regular gas stations. We have a limit for our cars. We need a tag on our front screen or front window in our cars to get our regular basics, our regular gas for our cars. So San Cristobal, it's tired of this. And I guess the lack of milk, the lack of toilet paper, as basic as that, meat, eggs, flour, cornmeal, cornflour, juice, everything. It's even soap bars for showering or shampoo. You won't find that here. So it's really hard for regular citizens, even the poor and middle class, have to deal with this every day. They have to make huge lines out of the supermarkets or grocery stores to get a hold of this. And we are talking just one side. Let's look at hospitals. As medical students, you'll find that hospitals are out of supplies, like no stitches, no medicines, no regular stuff that needs for surgery. So it's everything is going worse, and we need to change that.
Francisco, let's maybe you can give a little bit of a historical perspective, the transition from Hugo Chavez to Nicolas Maduro and sort of the increasingly sort of repressive atmosphere in the country. Can you give us a little bit of backdrop on that?
Well, sure. I mean, Hugo Chavez was a remarkably charismatic leader, and it's important to understand, it's not a myth, he was really beloved of millions of poorer Venezuelans, and beloved in a way that I think an audience in the U.S. might find difficult to understand, because it wasn't just a political thing. It almost became a mystical or almost a religious experience. Like, believing in Chavez became part of people's identity in Venezuela. And because he was so charismatic, but also because Venezuela is an oil country and he had so much money to spend, you know, oil prices have been so high, as you know, every time you go to pump gas, you can see this. Chavez, when he was in power, he didn't need to use that much violence or that much repression to stay in power, because he had this bond with, this mystical bond with the poor. And if that didn't work, he always had money to throw around the different constituencies to keep them happy. And what's happened in the last year since Chavez passed away is that on the one hand, the economy has gotten much worse. The accumulated effect of 15 years of really crazy economic policymaking has started to catch up with these guys. And so that's brought this insane exchange rate system where the black market exchange rate is 13 times what the official exchange rate is, and there's all kinds of scams and corruption going on around that. And the way that shows up in people's lives is that money that gets approved to import the things that Freddy wants to buy in San Cristobal, like toilet paper and chicken and everything else, it ends up getting diverted to these scams, and it does, and so those products don't show up on the shelves. Now, so the person that's been called on to deal with all these problems, Nicolas Maduro, he doesn't have the two key things that Chavez had that allowed him to deal with protests without using violence. He doesn't have the charisma. He's really a flat speaker. He wouldn't inspire a fly off the wall. And he doesn't have the money. So if you don't have the charisma and you don't have the money, what do you have? You have tear gas and you have rubber bullets and you have these colectivo paramilitary groups which get sent out to terrorize people in the neighborhoods. And that's what they've been relying on.
Well, and to maybe extrapolate just a little bit further, the way that I understand this is that when the importer imports the goods, they're paid 100%, but they might only deliver 50% of those goods to market. The other 50% then they take to the secondary or to the black market, and then they cash in again, but it makes for a very destabilized situation where not only don't you know what the goods and products are, but also that you're having to pay so much more and you're having to, in fact, pay twice for that. Yes?
Right. I mean, the details get a little bit complicated, but the thing to understand is that government policies create huge incentives to cheat on your import bill. Now, if you will just take some of the money that the government approves for imports and you'll divert it to the black market, you can really become a millionaire many times over overnight. And the key thing that you need to make that scam work is government connections. Now, who has the government connections? It's government-connected businessmen and government-connected military men. Now, so you want to know why the army is using so much violence, is so willing to use violence to repress these protests? It's because they're protecting their profits.
And Laura Weffer, on the streets of Caracas, one of the other issues that seems to be emerging and has been in place for quite some time is a lack of trust in police and the authority and the government to protect everyday citizens. True?
Yeah, it has been for many years, that the lack of trust is not new. But as Francisco was saying, while we have Chavez, it was controlled. And one of the main things that Chavez wanted to create was a bond between army and military men and civil people. So for maybe 15 years, he tried to create, you know, some kind of relationship between, he used to say, army men are not people coming from out of space. They are citizens as you and me. But right now, the police and the army has been used to repress the people who is protesting. And that lack of trust is growing exponentially fast. Is becoming more and more complicated because the repression has been extreme. Right now, they I'm a journalist. I am on the streets every day, but also I'm a neighbor of one of the most complicated places in Caracas, where every night we have to inhale tear gas while we are on the while we are in our houses. I have two little kids, and they are staying in my mom's house because they cannot stay in my house because we have so much tear gas every night in our houses. It's just insane. Of course, there is no trust. And most of the people who is protesting are students. Maybe the average of the ages are between 18, 17 years old until 25. And it's part of the nature of that age to be distrustful of security of the state.
There is also sort of a characterization, Laura, that this is sort of a class battle, that the middle and upper classes are now protesting. And while there's this sort of student contingent, there's also this class division that's going on. And that while they may be protesting at the same time, that they don't necessarily have the same goals in mind. Is that a fair characterization?
No, that's the government discourse.
Okay.
That's what they are trying to sell. You know, but it's not true. Two days ago, I spent the whole day in Plaza Altamira. It's where the people who is protesting are. They gather around in Plaza Altamira. And you can find there people from every class, class from Caracas. People really, really poor and people really high class. So it's a mix of classes. And while you talk to them, they all have the same objective. They all want the insecurity to be reduced. They want the government. It's interesting because they don't want it. They try to say that, they is the government. Try to say, oh no, they are trying to give a coup d'etat and they are trying to overthrow Maduro. And that's not true. Well, at least what they say is they want a change, not of the whole government, but they want a change of the way as the government is doing things. And they are tired of corruption, which is huge. Here they want the inflation, the prices, the shortage of the basic supplies. It has no excuse. Venezuelan being an oil country, a rich country, to be in this situation.
As we continue our discussion, a reminder that you can view or listen to this program anytime by downloading our podcast at globaljournalist.org. There you can find interesting articles, photos, and interviews related to this program. Please send us any questions you might have. Also comments at globaljournalist@kbia.org. You can also go to our Facebook page, and you can follow us on Twitter at @GlobalJourn. And Francisco Toro, let's talk a little bit more about some of the government moves, because, you know, we did establish earlier in the show that Caracas has been historically a very violent city. So you might think that the government saying we're going to increase police presence to ensure the safety of citizens might be a good move. But for those who would be critical of the government, they would say that this is simply a greater move towards a power grab and an irreversible course towards a more sort of totalitarian state. Yes?
Well, actually, I've seen a lot of protest placards that have reproduced a newspaper cartoon that shows a bunch of students thrown in jail surrounded by cops while common criminals go around being protected by the cops. I think that's a very common theme of frustration in the protest movement also, is that the government always says, well, you know, this huge crime wave that has made Venezuela one of the most violent places on earth, that's out of our control. There are deep social causes. There are root causes. It's going to take a generation. They kind of spin it out as this problem that nobody can do anything about. But what people see is that there are all the cops on the street, that there is a substantial police presence, but the cops are not running after the criminals. They're running after the students who are protesting for their rights.
Mm-hmm. And Freddy Gomez, I'm sure you've seen some of that firsthand, and I'm sure that it has to be a little bit frustrating that maybe the world's attention hasn't turned to Venezuela as much as maybe some of the protesters might hope.
Yeah, especially whenever you go to the streets and you're looking for a different look around. Like if you go as a demonstrator, you go looking for straight change, and then you see these people who supposed to protect us, shooting at us, or going straight against us, or, you know, just tear gas, especially whenever it's shoot straight to there, you can kind of handle that. But whenever those cans are shoot straight to your body, it's not fair. So it's in any case, it's straight violence against the people who is looking for a change in the regular life that Venezuelans have, and it's not okay for us.
Laura Weffer, how difficult is it to cover this? Has the government turned on journalists more and more?
Well, yeah. Actually, here in San Cristobal and near towns, the media, or reporters or press, usually they get stolen cameras and stuff from the colectivos, the paramilitary. So media, it's everyday censored. It's more closed eye from the government's perspective, so the war and other cities can see or watch what's happening in here.
Francisco, what is your take in terms of the crackdown? Because I know one of the ways that the government tries to control sort of dissenting voices, particularly in the newspapers, is to just limit the amount of newsprint that they make available to those dissenting voices.
Well, okay, let's step back a little bit here. The main thing that worries the government is radio and TV. These are the real mass media. This is what normal people in Venezuela, this is how they get their news.
Sure.
And that's been very heavily controlled. Newspapers, traditionally, the government left more space to because they had this feeling that maybe 10-15% of the population reads newspaper.
Right.
They're already middle class. They're already anti-government. That wasn't so high in their list of concerns. Now, what's really alarming is that over the past few months, we've seen the government start to go after newspapers, too. A very simple way to do it is just to limit imports of newsprint. Venezuela doesn't produce any newsprint. So if you're going to print the newspaper, you need paper. And that's actually been another of the more popular protest placards. Without newsprint, there's no newspaper. People have been protesting on this theme. But we've seen other tactics, too, that are, to my mind, even more troubling, which is that important newspapers, high-profile newspapers, have been getting bought up by secret investors whose names are not disclosed. The media chain, I think we lost Laura from the line, but the newspaper chain that Laura works in has been bought by nobody knows who. New pro-government management teams have been put in place, and so people are, the reporters who are just trying to do a job end up in a very strange position of working for a newspaper that is owned. Nobody knows who the owner is.
Francisco, do you feel that the world has turned enough attention to what's going on in Venezuela, and do you think that global pressure might do any good?
I don't want to be too critical of international media attention, in that I understand that this happened at the same time as the Ukrainian crisis, which from a geostrategic level, you know, if I'm an editor sitting in New York or London or wherever it is, I can see how Ukraine is a bigger deal. For Venezuelans, that conjunction has been really unfortunate and really exasperating. But I do think there's a sense that people feel like they sort of know what the story of the Chavez era is, you know, that people have made up their mind. Chavez was always very polarizing, and now the Maduro government has inherited that polarization. And so people have the sense that, oh, well, we know what that's about. That's, you know, it's either a revolutionary left-wing government battling fascists, or it's a dawning dictatorship. However, whichever narrative you want to go for,
right,
people feel like they sort of understand that. And so there's less appetite to sort of revise our views. And it has been a little bit hard to shake people into a realization that, no, that we've turned the page and we're onto a new stage here. And this kind of muddled democracy that we had under Chavez, that would had authoritarian traits but also had democratic traits, that's giving way to something that looks much more like a Cuban-style Fidelista dictatorship.
So, Laura Weffer, let's talk a little bit about the difficulty in covering these protests on the street. What have you encountered?
on year 2002, we used to go to the streets with a bulletproof vests and anti-tear gas mascaras and helmets on our heads. And I thought, well, I hope that I don't need to use this anymore in my life. But now we have to go again every day to cover the streets as we were in a war. It's been really, really difficult. Up to this point, there have been at least 100 journalists that has been beaten, that has been robbed, that has been detained. It doesn't matter if you are Venezuelan or international journalist. The police or the Guardia Nacional will detain you. It's been really difficult when you are on the streets. Normally, you get the solidarity or the support of the people, the students, the young people who is doing the protests. And it's difficult when you get into your office and you have to write about the whole thing, what is happening. Because sometimes I have to say and I have to admit, it's difficult to understand. There are so many things happening in one day. It's almost impossible to keep track on what is happening. Sometimes you need, in order to understand what is happening, you need to, you know, like to retreat, or you need to get far from the events of every day. But in Venezuela, we don't have that opportunity. We have to be on the streets every day, covering what is happening. I have to say that for me, it's really, really important the things that reporters are doing here. I'm not talking about media. Media is another thing. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about reporters. The reporters go every day to the streets to do their job, and regardless if it is published then or not, they go to the streets and they seek and they pick up the stories that are worthwhile to be told every day.
Do you believe, what do you believe might lead to an end to the present sort of progression of events?
Well, I don't know. That's really, anything that I could say, it will be a speculation. I have to say that I think we have an important international support of NGOs. And I think, well, we still have, with the web and the social media, we still have ways of letting other people knowing what's going on. For example, Twitter has become a phenomenon here in Venezuela. Mm. And I have a friend that was telling me the other day, well, we passed from the time, well, something is happening, please turn on the TV to know what is happening, to say, oh, something is happening, please look on the Twitter what is happening. Because we have nothing on TV or radio station that shows reality every day. So we have turned to social media, and Facebook and Twitter have become our salvation in terms of letting people know what is happening. On the other hand, I have to say that I work in Cadena Capriles, and we still have sometimes we have room to maneuver. So we have published a very important video and an article that reveal who were the killer of one of the guys that the kids that were killed on the 12th of February. Mm. The people who killed that kid, his name is Basil da Costa, were police, were people from intelligence, and we published it, and it ran. And it was recognized by the government, and allegedly, because we are not sure, that people is behind bars. So we are going to fight. We are going to fight until they let us. And we are not going to give away our right to inform. We are going to fight until we can.
Francisco Toro, that fight that continues on, it appears to be increasingly difficult, though, does it not? And what is your perspective from Montreal?
Well, I talk to a lot of reporters in Venezuela, and of course, they're in a very difficult position because the government has shown again and again that they will take action to shut you down if you're publishing things that they don't want published. Okay? So any time a Venezuelan reporter is sitting down to write, that is in the back of their mind. You know, your job is on the line with every article, but not only your job. If you're in a radio station, the broadcast license can be taken away overnight. Colombian news station NTN 24, which is a sort of northern South America CNN type outfit, was taken off the air really in a matter of minutes because Nicolas Maduro saw a report on NTN that he didn't like. So there is a lot of pressure. There's a lot of pressure for self-censorship. People like Laura are down there fighting the good fight, you know, and trying to push the boundaries and push the envelope as far as possible. But that is a day-by-day thing. You never know when that's going to come to an end.
And to the question of, you know, it's sort of couched as optimism and pessimism, and I'm not sure those are really good terms to put, but do you see something that might develop that might help to move the needle in the other direction?
In the other direction towards more freedom?
Yes.
Pressure on the street. I don't think there's any other way. What people need to understand is that constitutional government and the rule of law have collapsed in Venezuela. So all the courts are controlled by the regime, all the institutions, the human rights ombudsperson, the ombudsman, which is an ombudsman, is clearly a regime crony who has recently been quoted sort of making excuses for torture under detention. All of the checks and balances, all of the institutions that are written into the Constitution to limit executive overreach, they're all under the direct control of the president. So he's elected, but he governs like a dictator. And that is the simple reality. So the normal way that you would look for redress, which would be institutional, doesn't work at all. And so the only way you really have any chance to make your voices heard is to go out in the street. And this is why people are out on the street, because they don't really have any other choice. It's imaginable that if this goes on long enough and you put enough pressure on the government for long enough, maybe they'll start to backtrack. There's a big movement now to pressure the government's human rights ombudsman to resign and to have someone genuinely independent and somebody who will look after human rights issues seriously take that job. And maybe that will work. I don't have a crystal ball.
Right. Freddy Gomez, to that issue of being optimistic, pessimistic, where do you stand?
Well, I still being optimistic, even though if we have lose many Venezuelan citizens, even National Guard or students or regular people as a demonstrator for looking for peace or looking for a change, I still being optimistic that our country it's going to head in a way that we all can live safe with regular goods in our supermarkets and grocery stores and medical supplies in all our hospitals. So I really am optimistic with a Venezuela happy, safe, secure, and well.
Thank you so much for all of your perspectives. We've come to the end of this week's edition of Global Journalist, produced by the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Today, we were joined by Venezuelan blogger and analyst Francisco Toro, investigative journalist Laura Weffer, and medical student Freddy Gomez, who's been on the streets with those protesters in San Cristobal, which is one of the hotbeds of protesting going on recently in Venezuela. Global Journalist is directed by Travis McMillan, audio by Pat Akers. Mikhail Christensen is our executive producer. Olga Krishtalevo was this week's lead producer. And please join us again next week as we have yet another edition of Global Journalist. I'm Jim Plinkett.